and welcome to episode 12 of WB40, the weekly podcast about technology with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hi, Matt. How are you? It's been another exciting week.
Another exciting week indeed. Yeah, no, I'm very well, having survived an experiment with rum and raisin ice cream over the weekend, which is my noisiest home appliance and piece of technology is the ice cream maker. And I have to put it into a completely separate room because of the sheer blessed noise the thing makes. But rum and raisin, thoroughly recommend it.
Well, that's a taste that I've not had for many a year. Rum and raisin ice cream. Sounds like you're going back to the 70s with your flavours.
Quite, I think, possibly. The
owning an ice cream maker, though, Matt, is a highly bourgeois thing. And the fact that then you can put it in another room suggests that you are part of the metropolitan elite, and that Mr. Trump will be around your house anytime soon.
Although I might be just using alternative facts.
Oh, it's been an excellent week and very very enlightening for those of us who like to see how language is used and deployed. The alternative fact, that's all. Let's all be thankful for the alternative fact.
Yes, I think we should just basically call a spade and a lie a lie.
Oh dear me, that's how very boring. You know, you can be economical with the truth, as Sir Humphrey might have said. That's not the same thing.
No, there was, though, an interesting conversation I had, I think with you as well, actually, on Twitter a couple of days ago, saying about how, you know, Sean Spicer, the wordsmith and fantasist, and how he'd been basically obviously put out to stump to lie. And somebody saying, yeah, but surely that's just what we've always had to do all the time in ever writing a business case ever. And just, yes, but there's scales of lying.
Yeah, absolutely. There's optimism, and then there's outright lying. But speaking of lying, we're going to be talking about some Brexit issues this week, and then we're going to be talking about how organisations cope with the rise of people needing to work but not from a PC.
So way back in episode 2 of WB40, back in 2016, and when we were still finding our podcasting feet, we discussed the technology implications of Brexit. Now, back then, in those heady days, nobody quite knew what the hell was going on. Now, obviously, we've moved on a great deal from that particular time, but with announcements from the Prime Minister last week, there seems to be a bit more clarity going on. Into the approach that Britain is going to be taking to leaving the European Union. So probably a good time just to be able to get a bit of an update as to where we think the technology management implications of Brexit may lie and how people might be preparing themselves for what will be happening over the next couple of years. Now, Chris, you've given a couple of talks about this to various audiences over the last few months. Obviously, for the last few, you've been doing that in a completely uninformed manner, which is very brave of you, although being uninformed is obviously something that doesn't stop either of us. But
comes naturally.
I know, absolutely. I didn't do a degree in sociology to not be able to witter on about anything I like. But where are your thoughts now in terms of some of the key issues that you've been talking about in terms of Brexit, given now that it looks like we're going to be going for the hard stroke clean version of the thing?
Yeah, when I was talking about this last year, really what I was doing was outlining some risks that may present themselves around people. Will people be allowed to stay in the UK, or will they be frightened or spooked or sent away through whatever situation we find ourselves in? Around finance, how the value of sterling had fallen, how that would affect projects, and around things around data sovereignty. So where could you keep information, those sort of things. And also about how systems would have to be reconfigured if we suddenly find ourselves outside of a customs union, outside of a single market, and having to build in lots of different timings, lots of different costings, different paperwork and permissions for things to cross into the EU. But yes, that was all. It was all pretty much potential risks. I think, as you say, Mrs. May has done away with the hard and soft Brexit, and she prefers the clean Brexit terms. But this is essentially a hard Brexit. What she's set out is an absolute withdrawal from customs union, from single market, and that will have an effect. Okay, it may be a negotiating tactic, but I find that very difficult to believe, given that really it seems that we want to be away from, for example, the jurisdiction of the European Court. And when you do deals in the single market, in the customs union, you are subject to that as an arbiter if there are disagreements between parties. So yeah, I think there are. I think some of the risks are starting to crystallise. They're not yet. They haven't yet come to pass. But I think the likelihood of them coming to fruition in some way or another is starting to grow. And I think people ought to be making plans for this.
So let's go through them in order then. So starting off with the people challenges. So where do you see that now?
Well, the government is not willing to give any guarantees about the status of EU citizens that are here now, and we've seen quite a lot of stories of EU citizens being told that they can't, their citizenship applications have not been successful and things like that. So now a lot of that may be media beat up, but I think it will spook people. It'll spook people that are here now, and it will potentially put off people coming into the economy over the next couple of years as we go through the divorce part of the Brexit deal. So for people who hire EU citizens, because we're a big economy, we're one of the biggest economies in Europe, and we attract a lot of people. For those people who use EU citizens in our IT teams, I think that's a piece of what they really have to do now, is to get people on board, make them understand that they probably will have permission to stay, but to do that, they'll need to get things like bills and rent agreements and all these things that show that they've had a reason to be in the UK, and engage with them and try to mitigate that risk of people deciding that they're better off elsewhere. And also for those people who are maybe working in the EU but are British citizens as well, we need to think about those guys and how will their right to work in the EU change on the back of any deal. We still don't know what that'll look like, but the signs are probably harder than they were a few months ago.
I think there's a bit of an irony as well that if you saw in the last day or so some of the commentary about Australia and the ability for the UK to do a trade deal with Australia. Australia say that they're very up for being able to do a quick trade deal, and they did one with the US in 8 months or something. But then they also said, and probably we'll be looking to be able to see if we can make it easier for Australian immigration to happen into the UK, for people to be able to come and work in the UK from Australian companies. So that might actually, as we start to have the negotiations, which obviously won't start really in earnest for quite some time yet, from my understanding it can't happen whilst we're still members of the EU, but that what we might well see is from other trading nations that we want to be able to do deals with, the quid pro quo for that actually about being able to get their people's skills and talents easier into the UK to be able to work in companies that are based here. So for Australia, for New Zealand, who knows where else, that could have some interesting implications.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. And it's one to watch, absolutely. And if we move on to the issue of systems and configuration, that's aligned with it really, because there's two parts of this Brexit deal. The first is the 2 years of Brexit, started by Article 50, whenever that happens, and tomorrow, by the time this podcast lands on people's doorsteps, there'll be a Supreme Court judgment about whether Parliament is allowed to, whether Parliament has to be involved in giving an Article 50 notification. So Article 50 is notified, then we have 2 years of negotiating a way out. Now, part of that negotiation will have to be about the transitionary or transitory agreements after 2 years. that are in place whilst we did actually hammer out a trade deal with the EU. Now, the trade deal with the EU is going to take a long time. So it's down to those transition arrangements, whether, for example, we will continue to use the CE mark on electrical goods, or will we have to come up with our own standard or use an international standard or whatever that allows electrical goods to go into the EU without being tested and checked at borders, for example, whether we'll be able to continue to trade without tariffs. And all of those things are going to have to be watched really carefully, because all of those systems that manage logistics to and from the EU, and let's face it, there are a lot of companies, a lot of organizations that move parts and machinery backwards and forwards to the EU to have different operations done to them, and they don't have to have any impact on that movement at the moment, but that will have to change when and if there are significant barriers put in the way. So the movement of goods as well as people will be affected, and anybody that's running systems that manage those will need to watch what happens in the next 12 months, certainly very carefully, so that they've got plans and contingency in place should difficulties come along.
And budget as well, presumably. It's actually being able to ring fence some money up ahead for the potential contingency that will be needed to reconfigure systems going into whatever comes out the back of the Article 50 process.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So that brings us to the finance elements of this. Your thoughts as to where, with what we know now, things are at?
I'm not sure we can say much about that, really, other than sterling took a beating when we originally left. And every time we've talked about leaving since, it's gone down. The government, they preceded the Prime Minister's recent comments reasonably well, so there wasn't so much of a shock in terms of sterling. But I think it's there to stay now, isn't it? Sterling against the dollar, for example. And we are going to be paying more for Cisco stuff and Dell stuff and HP stuff. All of those things are going to cost more. So I think that's just a reality of life now, that we have to make sure that all the budgets that are set for capital equipment like that are sufficient. On the positive side, I've spoken to organisations who are ramping up their development teams in the UK and stopping doing so much offshoring because the UK teams are now more cost effective. So there's definitely positives. For every negative, you can find a positive in terms of the currency. So again, that might mean that a business case that wasn't possible last year is now possible again. So it might be worth IT directors, CIOs dusting off some of those old business cases that got pushed back to see if they're now worth doing in the new the new world.
I guess the other broader industry, still unknown, but with direction of travel now a bit clearer, this is going to be an issue, is the amount of software licensing from the software industry that goes through Luxembourg or Ireland. And if we're not going to be part of a single market, and depending on where trade deals end up, that's going to have to change one way or another.
Well, yeah, and a lot of these software license deals, if you dig into the small print, there are changing law clauses or clauses that allow the companies to change the price if the cost of doing business changes dramatically. And that's, again, just, it's not a risk. It's not a risk that's crystallized right now, but some of these license agreements are pretty tortuous, and I wonder how many of us really know the detail of them or have passed them through the legal department. And those I think all of those things need to be measured now in to be ready for sort of these things if they do occur.
And then the final one was data sovereignty. Are we any clearer about where the implications for where data resides, where it sits, how we use it, how it transfers across organisations and across countries is going to be?
Again, that's one to watch. I think it really depends on how well the UK implements. So GDPR will come into force before we leave the EU. And at that point, we'll have commensurate legislation, and everything will be fine. The moment we start to play around with GDPR, or even there are people that will tell you that the Investigatory Powers Bill, for example, is contrary to GDPR, and therefore we will not be compliant with that when we leave. I'm not so sure. I'll wait to see how that pans out. But it really does depend on how the government chooses to keep those laws or amend them after we leave. And then maybe if we are not seen to have an appropriate level of data protection compared to GDPR, then we will have to make some other arrangements. So again, that is one to watch, but I think that one's quite hard to call at this point.
So the mist isn't necessarily totally clearing at this stage, but at least we know it's a mist and we know there's something behind it. Should CIOs have a Brexit plan in place?
I think so. I think they should have had a Brexit plan in place last year, but just maybe even just a list of risks for the business. I think some of those risks are starting to crystallise, and therefore you move those plans on a little bit and you don't throw them gleefully in the bin as maybe you might have thought you could have done. So, Matt, you wrote an article a few weeks ago about, well, you call it No PC, about this, about the idea that now there are so many different types of devices, so many form factors, so many ways that people want to work. And actually, the PC is a fairly restrictive piece of kit, and a lot of the software that it relies upon uses things like A4 form factors for documents, and it's all fairly, it all kind of harks back to the typewriter and how organizations should aspire to move on from that, even in a gradual way. So it's about, you've been stewing on that for a while. So what's your current thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's, I think this is a broader piece of thinking about actually why isn't enterprise IT thinking about the future? Is it just thinking about how it does sustaining innovations? So you use the Clayton Christensen language. It's not thinking about disruptive change. It's thinking about sustaining innovations. And that is already showing that it's creaking at the edges. And I guess born of work that I've been doing in the last few years, working with IT groups in many different sectors, just not seeing people being able to see what's going on around them. The article I wrote got a bit of debate going. I know there's a couple of people from Microsoft a bit involved in that, and they kind of took umbrage about it because it felt, I guess, like an attack on Microsoft. It's not. Microsoft, I think, if you look at what they're talking about strategically, seem to acknowledge the world is about mobile and cloud, and they're a player in one of those, but the mobile thing they've kind of lost out on. But it's not about the PC isn't going to be around soon. It will be around for a long while to come. I was in conversations today with somebody who talked about a particular virtualization problem they had because they had an ICL mainframe and they couldn't virtualize it because it was an ICL mainframe. And just, stuff can stay around. You get a very long tail of technology de-adoption. That's not even a word, is it? But
I read today that most of the United States air traffic control systems are written in ADA.
Oh yes, I can well believe it. And so it's not about that PCs are going to disappear overnight. I think they will go over a very long time, all of a sudden, in the way that fax machines did. I'm still lingering around in little pockets, but they're mostly gone now. But it's more about actually, how do we understand the way in which the consumption of computing power and computing resource and data and information and functionality and process is going to change from it being consumed with a device that's got a screen, a keyboard and a mouse? And I just don't think that enterprise IT is even beginning to think about this for the most part. So I've been trying to sort of distill it down into the kind of contributory factors. What are the things that are meaning these changes are happening, and some of them historical, some of them are now, and just to be able to sort of break these trends down a bit, and the kind of the culmination of all these things happening at the same time means that there's this, I believe, this immense pressure for change. And I kind of got a list of about 8.5, I guess. So the first one is the browser. Now, the browser's been around since the early 90s. We saw the browser wars in, the mid-90s, when Microsoft and Netscape were vying to who could have browser supremacy, and Microsoft won that particular battle. The key thing about the browser was that it became the new operating system. And if you look at the way in which applications these days are built, putting aside apps that are built for mobile devices, the majority of applications that are built today are built for the browser. There are very few installed onto a PC bits of software because it's such a pain in the backside. It's such a bad way to be able to deliver software. And you can do pretty much anything in the browser these days. You can edit video in the browser. You can edit images in the browser. You can do audio editing in the browser. There's a stack of things that, you know, even maybe 5 years would have been fairly unimaginable that now the browser can handle. And the browser as the operating system, I think, is a really interesting idea. Rather than thinking about it as an application that sits in an operating system, you need to think about it as an OS in its own right. And it's an OS that is portable to many devices. You can use it on a TV screen. You can use it on a touchscreen mobile phone. You can use it on a PC. It might be a crap experience if it's not been designed in a way to be sympathetic to those different forms. But this is 20 years of technology now, and it's 20 years of technology that's been evolving alongside but independently of the PC.
Well, that's right. And also the where you process your data is changing, isn't it? We keep going backwards and forwards. We, you know, we went from mainframes back down to the desktop, back to cloud. There are new devices now that are coming out, new, much smaller devices that allow edge computing and what they call fog computing in the network to save you having to transfer lots of information backwards and forwards up to some central cloud system. But you're right, the actual the thing that you do the processing on in terms of the image manipulation or text manipulation can be a very, very thin thing indeed.
And it's I think, though, that there is still this idea that you need to be able to build an operating system that is hardened, and being able to make it this thing that is unique to the organisation. And I just don't understand why, if most of the things that you're using are browser-based, which they should be these days. So the second one is the Mac. Now, this is a bit of an odd one because the Mac is, of course, a PC. It's not a Windows PC. But back in the 90s, Apple went on a meandering journey of nonsense, and they produced lots of beige boxes that were deeply unimpressive. They were sustained by the fact that they had this toehold in the publishing industry, and desktop publishing and font management and PostScript were the reasons why Apple survived. I'm over the years convinced of that. And the point at which Microsoft needed to put an investment, to my memory, of something like $100 million to keep Apple afloat was really important, because if it hadn't have had Apple there, even though Apple was getting this tiny little sliver of what was this enormous market for personal computers, Microsoft would have had a monopoly, and if they'd had a monopoly, they would have got broken up. So Microsoft made the strategic decision, and very wisely, to be able to invest into into Apple, and as a result, Apple survived. And then Jobs came back, and then, you know, the hagiography that there is about what happened from that point onwards. But as Macs have become more and more desirable, what has started to happen is that the need to be able to support more than one operating system in the enterprise, it's never become massively widespread, but it's happened at a very senior level. Macs have become tools within the marketing organization, and then tools carried by senior executives, and then latterly Macs, and then iPads and iPhones. And that has had the impact of, in many organisations now, the need and necessity to be able to deliver multi-platform, which in turn has reinforced the idea that the browser is the way in which you deliver applications these days.
Absolutely. So what's your next point then, Matt?
So the next one is the big obvious one, and that's mobile. So we're 10 years since the launch of the iPhone. Mobile phones were around before that. Smartphones existed before that. I had a fairly grotty but useful experience of using the internet using Nokia phones before iPhones and Android phones came about in 2007 onwards. we have, though, seen this dramatic switch in the way in which people consume computing because of the rise of smartphones in the last 10 years. So we've got most people now in the UK have a smartphone. The way in which people use those devices is increasingly the primary way in which they access computing resource and web-based resource. It's not to say that people are only using smartphones, but increasingly we are relying on the smartphone beyond their PC. They're also deeply personal things. They are way, way, way more personal than the personal computer ever was. There's a little experiment that I've done a few times in an audience where you ask people to get out their phones, unlock them, and hand them to the person to the left of them. And there's two really interesting things that come out of that. The first is that people will do anything that somebody on a stage tells them to do, which is our submission to authority and a whole bunch of interesting things around psychology and social psychology. But the other side of that is that people feel, you can feel palpable discomfort in the room as a complete stranger is holding what is a portal into their inner lives. And I just will say something like, go and have a little play, see what you can find, and then stop them very quickly because the discomfort is too great. So these devices have become so embedded into our daily lives now, and the majority of people's daily lives, and an increasing majority of daily lives. And also in emerging economies, what we're seeing is that the mobile phone is being used to completely skip a generation of technology where PCs just will never be seen, because you don't need a PC if you've got a smartphone. In Asia in particular, and actually to an extent on the consumer web, you'll find now often applications will be developed for smartphone alone. And then over time, there might be something that's developed for PC. So something like WhatsApp. WhatsApp, there is a web client for, you can access on a PC now, but it definitely wasn't the first way in which they developed it. And emerging software now will develop for iOS, will develop for Android, will develop for web. And there are very, very, very few cases where people will develop an application dedicated to run on a PC or a Mac.
No, that's true. And delivering software to a mobile device isn't that difficult, really. It's not a massive job to create a simple app. And where you get what I guess we still call developing countries, where broadband infrastructure is still very, very patchy, the 3G, 4G infrastructure is better. So people are using mobiles for and smartphones for a lot of business and commercial use.
So next up is software as a service and cloud. I think software as a service particularly, though, because actually what that's meaning is we're starting to see a change in the way in which data is used and consumed, which means that it doesn't sit on hard drives. We had a little disaster a couple of weeks ago when we recorded the first episode of the year. And the SD card that I use in the audio recorder that records these shows corrupted as I put it into the PC. And it made me realise actually how rarely now I'm dependent on a single piece of data existing in a single place on a single device. And I know the reason why I don't like that, and I feel uneasy when that happens. It's because shit like that happens. The fact that we now expect our data to be accessible from any device means that actually the hard drive of the personal computer, the Mac or the Windows device, is a massive liability. And that we just expect, and we don't even really notice the way in which if we go from Facebook in the web to Facebook on an app to Facebook on the web in the office, to it's just there. We don't have to think about the way in which we transfer data and files with these kind of services. And that should be the way in which computing is, not that you have to be able to access something on something, because that's not only inherently risky, but it's also a really crap experience if you need to be able to rely on a single device to be able to access something.
Absolutely. I think where you see that problem now is not so much the technology, is it? It's more the ecosystem. So still, to transfer a file from an Android device to an Apple device or vice versa is really difficult because of the way Apple tie their devices up. But that's down to a corporate decision rather than a technological one.
Yeah, and this is the lock-in across domains, isn't it? That, you know, software companies forever have been trying to be able to get customer lock-in, and they do it through either completely nefarious means or by making good products. And it's usually a combination of the both. But you can see this absolutely. The Google infrastructure is accessible from Mac devices through apps. The Apple infrastructure, they've made the strategic decision that it is accessible from nothing other than Apple devices, with a very few exceptions. Microsoft are trying to do it as well through both Windows and also through the Office. And I think from an enterprise perspective, Office 365, the amount of additional stuff they continue to bundle into that is making it both extremely useful but incredibly susceptible to massive lock-in. And that idea of not being able to share across these ecosystems is stronger now, actually, than it has been for some time, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, isn't there? But I think your next point about the social web is basically what you're saying there about Facebook. People expect, even on an Android device or an Apple device or their PC, to be able to see the same information. But if Apple had their way, they wouldn't have Facebook on Apple devices. They would have their own
Apple friends.
Apple friends, indeed. So it's only when something is already ubiquitous, like, so for example, Office on Apple devices, or, you know, Office for Mac and all of that kind of thing, that's where it breaks down these barriers, because people just demand it.
But I think this is the interesting point about the social web, Web 2.0. Sounds terribly dated now, doesn't it? I remember when that was the future. But that what these are training people to do is to realise that actually you don't need to have email, a word processor, a slide deck and a spreadsheet to be able to collaborate and work with other people. If you look in the way in which people organise their lives outside of work now using platforms like Facebook, if you look at the move that platforms like Facebook are trying to make into the enterprise. I'm still not convinced of the idea of the Facebook at work, or however it's branded now. But undoubtedly, we are learning to be able to communicate and collaborate with people that doesn't rely on the production of an A4 document that will only ever be viewed on screen, which is still the primary paradigm for how information is shared, collaborated upon, distributed within traditional enterprise organisations. And that's a really big issue. And I think people outside of technology communities are now starting to wake up to that. I was doing some work last year in a firm, and one of the partners of the company said to me, I'd like to be able to communicate with this group of people. I'd like to use WhatsApp because it's what I use to organise my friends and family outside of work. And I know how it works and it's good. And I just know it will work for the people I'm dealing with. And the initial response to that from the IT group was, this isn't a proper system. Why don't you use Yammer? Because that's what we've bought for that kind of work. But in the end, after we'd got over some of the security concerns about it, it was clear that WhatsApp was the way in which this guy wanted to go. And I think we'll see more and more of that as people learn that it doesn't have to be email attachment to lots of people, or even email link to shared document. Actually, documents themselves are not great collaborative forms. The other element then of what goes on within the emerging Web 2.0 apps ecosystem and all the rest of it is the prevalence of APIs, application programming interfaces, the ability to be able to call function and data from an application from another application relatively easily. And this is what an awful lot of what we see today in modern consumer, it's not even the internet, in modern consumer technology, is driven by APIs. This is what's enabling you to be able to post your thoughts from Twitter to Facebook, or it's what's enabling you to be able to log in using your Google ID to be able to access, I don't know, a photo sale website or whatever. And this way of being able to have interfacing between systems that in enterprise IT terms was expensive, clunky, mostly didn't work, was horrendously difficult to maintain, would fall over all the time because of the fact it was so brittle. And now we have an entire internet that is founded upon machine-to-machine communication.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that we probably have a longer conversation about this in future podcasts, but organizations that start to think about their data and how it's moved around and build open systems around that rather than use monolithic ERP to constrain them will be the ones that succeed in future. But and that's that's a culmination of all of the things you've said, actually, but it's enabled by the rise of the API economy.
And how many organisations make APIs available within their organisation for employees to be able to consume? If you look at services like If This Then That or Zapier, which are simple programming interfaces that enable you to connect multiple web-based services together. So when somebody tweets something, you can get your Internet of Things light bulb to go on or whatever takes your fancy. We should be seeing that kind of thing to be able to enable innovation and creative use of systems and technology within organisations. But I know of very few where they're even starting to scratch the surface of what would happen if you would expose those APIs internally, let alone what would happen if you expose those APIs externally. That brings me to the seventh factor, which is around Internet of Things. And as we start to see more and more connected devices, again, enterprise IT at the moment struggles to think of anything as a device other than a PC, maybe a phone, maybe a printer, a network router. That's your lot. And as just about everything becomes connectable to the network, there's huge, huge, huge possibility for that. This huge, interesting, as we've discussed on the show before, security implications. But none of that will happen, because if I take in an Internet of Things device into the average workplace, it will not connect to the internet. It will not connect to the network. It will not be allowed to connect to the network. The network has been designed and built in a way that untrusted devices cannot be there. And massive opportunities will just never be able to be exposed because people can't start to play around with these things.
Absolutely. So what's next on your list, Matt?
So from Internet of Things, what we're now starting to see, and I think it's a peak of first wave of hype. I think we're a long way from mainstream, but new interaction patterns, new ways of being able to interact with this web of technology as opposed to just an Internet of Data, which enables people to be able to walk into a room, say, Alexa, turn on the lights and play me some music, please. And the lights that are provided by Philips Hue and the music that's being provided by Spotify both come to life. That sort of world in the home, we've been saying for some time now that people are getting frustrated with the fact that the technology that they have at home is inferior to that they have at work. And that was a shift that happened probably 10 years ago, maybe even slightly more actually, as we started to get mass adoption of broadband at home. And that was, the single biggest contributory factor. Once we got decent internet connections, reasonably decent internet connections at home, that opened up the home to being able to be a much more creative, rich technology experience than that we find in the office. With the Internet of Things, with APIs, with the social web, with software as a service, with mobile, and with these new interaction patterns like voice or like wearable devices or gestures or being able to trigger things based on the fact that different systems are interacting with one another, we enter into a whole new world of how the richness of technology will sit within our lives, both inside and outside of work. I don't see any of that even beginning to scratch the surface in most enterprises today. At best, they'll be looking about how they might be able to enable little bits of these things for their consumer customers to use. But most organisations do not have the first idea about how they might be able to take advantage of any of this stuff. Which brings me to my...
They will be pushed that way, though, won't they, Matt? I think if you look at the way smartphones got adopted in enterprises, certainly in my experience, enterprises use BlackBerries because BlackBerries could have a lot more control around them, and there was a nice BlackBerry server for emails and it integrated Exchange. But what you get was a lot of people and quite... high ranking people in the organization would say, no, hold on a minute, I've got an iPhone, make this work. And the IT department would say, but we don't support that. And eventually they'd be made to show them how to connect to an Exchange account. And those things are kind of, it's kind of people, peer pressure makes it happen. So I think as these come into the workplace, It will be a pressure will make these things happen.
It will. I think that if you look at how painful it has been, though, to be able to... I mean, even BlackBerry came through the back door in many organisations, and you had a BES server, BlackBerry Enterprise server, sitting there that nobody quite supported properly because it was just there because the chief exec said they needed to have a BlackBerry and we needed to rush it in at the last minute. And then it sort of evolved into a sustainable service and eventually got to the point. If you look at the complexity that's involved in being able to deliver the services that are coming in all directions now, corporate IT just will not be able to cope with its current models of how it manages, supports, delivers technology. And
that's right. Maybe a future podcast we can talk about managed services and how that will be the future of how IT is delivered rather than building.
Well, what it might actually be, if we are seriously moving to a world where actually computing becomes utility, it might be that we don't have corporate IT at all anymore. And that would be the interesting, you know, next consequence of what goes on. And that then brings me to my final half a point, which isn't really about technology trends, but it's just a sort of general truism, which is nothing lasts forever. It's really easy to think that the personal computer will be around forever because it's been around for a while. But it won't be. And it will not be around for much more than the next, I don't know. Certainly within the next decade, I think we'll see a significant shift away from the use of personal computer type devices in the workplace. Just because people will not need to use them. Because quite frankly, on the one side of it, it's that they're not a great way to be able to interact with technology these days in comparison to many other options. Another factor is the fact that a lot of our work is constrained by the form factor today, and as people start to break away from that, they'll start to see that they don't need the PC. And then the final part is actually, as we see increasing automation based around, particularly around machine learning and artificial intelligence, a lot of the things that people use a PC for will just disappear because you won't need to do them anymore. I heard a wonderful quote a few years back which said if people learn how to use Excel macros, half the workforce would disappear overnight. And I think that's the point that's more than anything. An awful lot of the work that we do using PCs today actually isn't of very great value. It's repetitive, not very intelligent work that has to be done because people don't know any other ways of doing it. They'll either find ways about being able to automate that for themselves, or they'll find themselves automated out of existence or out of a job at least.
Well, I think that's a very comprehensive roundup of why the PC and why organisations should be looking to provide environments that aren't reliant on PCs or don't require PCs. And I wonder how many people will set that though as an objective sometime in the next 2 or 3 years. I'd hope more than a handful. I'd hope that people would start to see that as something that they really need to set as a when we don't really make 5-year plans in IT these days. But I think you can set some longer term objectives if you've got the vision to do so.
I think, yeah, and no PC, I'll repeat it again, it's not to say PCs won't exist, but we should be having something more aspirational than saying that the next iteration of transformation within the IT department is the next version of Microsoft Office. There's way more happening than that.
Well, thank you, Matt. That's been yet another fascinating episode. I'm thinking about next week. I don't quite know what we're going to do. We've been talking about a couple of different interviews, one of which will probably come off, but we don't know which one that is yet, so you'll have to wait and see. I think from my point of view, this is going to be another interesting week. We're going to find out exactly what Mr. Trump's going to do in America. We're going to see whether the Supreme Court will allow us to just go ahead and leave the Europe without a parliamentary vote. There's all sorts of ramifications going to happen this week and on the political front. So let's wait and see what happens.
And Watford are playing Millwall at the New Den, which might not be the New Den for very much longer.
I can only quiver with anticipation at that particular clash of the titans.
The magic of the cup. So there we go, another episode in the can. Thank you for joining us. Join us next week. You can subscribe to WB40 on iTunes. You can find us at wb40podcast.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at wb40podcast. See you next week.